All right, welcome to Baptist Basics University course on the Gospel of John. This is lesson number 14. Simple title for this one. We're going to call it Two Miracles. We're going to deal with the feeding of the 5,000 and Christ walking on the sea. And these two are not intrinsically related, I guess you can say, but they do happen back to back, and there is some connection in the narrative, so we're going to go ahead and cover both of those in this lesson. Now, the last three lessons, we got through the John chapter 5. We're going to try to get through John chapter 6 in two lessons. We're going to get through the first 21 verses in this, and then we're going to cover about the last 50 or so verses in the following lesson, cover a lot of ground there. So let's go ahead and get introduction done. Christ has made quite an impression on the people of Israel. I really doubt by this time in his ministry that there's anyone who knows anything in the nation of Israel that does not know about him, that hasn't heard about the miracles, that hadn't heard about his teachings. He is a very popular person still among the people. There are those who are opposing him, especially the religious leaders who are seeking to destroy him. But nonetheless, he is in spite of the controversy surrounding him and his claims, he still has throngs of people seeking him out. And now, as we've already seen, he has been avoiding the main area for Judaism around Jerusalem. He's been hanging out more in Galilee, which of course was called Galilee of the Gentiles. There's a lot more of a Gentile influence up there. It's kind of considered the backwoods country. So he's able to hide out up there and be and still have popularity, still have people seeking him out. But by being up there, he does avoid a lot of the religious turmoil taking place around Jerusalem. Now, he doesn't completely avoid Jerusalem. He does go there on the feast. Now, historians tell us there is no record of him ever spending the night within the walls of Jerusalem. That could be very true. You know, we honestly don't know. We know that at other times he would resort to the Mount of Olives and the Garden of Gethsemane and places like that, or travel down the road to Bethany. So it's possible he may never have. I don't know if you want to count. Well, the whole trial deal, he never was really so much in prison and spent the night in jail or anything. All the trials and stuff are going on before his crucifixion. But anyway, regardless, chase that rabbit there. Let's go ahead and get into this story. Christ is going to be back in his native Galilee. Verse 1, after these things, Jesus went over the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. This was, why does it have two names? It actually has a bunch of names. It's called the Gennesaret, I believe is how you say it. That's kind of the name you can hear about now. Sea of Galilee is more of a regional name for the region, Galilee. And the Sea of Tiberias, this was one of those things where the local ruler wanted to impress the new Caesar. So what do? You name a town or a mountain or a lake or something after him. So they gave this lake a new name, the Sea of Tiberias. So there may have been people, as this circulated throughout the Roman Empire after its writing, that would not have recognized the Sea of Galilee and not really understood what that was, but they would have understood the Sea of Tiberias, possibly. So Jesus is back up there, verse 2, and a great multitude followed him because they saw his miracles, which he did on them which were diseased. So that there's still a lot of people up there. I kind of skipped a point there in the notes. This is going to take place near the village of Bethesda. And it's on the northeastern shore of the Sea of Galilee, just a little bit east of kind of the northeast side there. If you were to cut it in half, it's just barely onto the right side of the Sea of Galilee. You can look it up on a map. You can look Luke chapter 9 verse 10 is a parallel passage, and you can see that this takes place near that village, not at the village, but near the village. And if you were to travel to the whole end day, they think they have the place where this took place. There's a little bit of debate about that, but nonetheless, you can get pretty doggone close if you are to go. Now, as I've already read in verse 2, multitudes of people have followed him, mostly for his miracles. And he's about to work another miracle that's going to give them even further reason to follow him. That's when he's going to feed them. So, boy, the way to a man's heart is through his stomach, and the way to get a throng of people after you is to fill their bellies, especially in times of uncertainty such as taking place at that time in Judea. Now, verse 4, we'll see in the Passover Feast of Jesus was nigh, so this takes place somewhere in February or March, maybe a few months after the preceding event, somewhere in there. I believe I said a few lessons back that the previous lesson, it never says in chapter 5 what feast it was, it just says a feast. We don't know what that was. It's got to be either the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Feast of Tabernacles, or the Passover, and I think I said it was probably the Passover. As I've done a little more study, I'm not quite so sure about that. But we know we can definitely nail this down. So it may be a year, it may be 3 or 4 months later. Regardless, with the feast being nigh, it's probably in February or March. So we're going to see here. We'll get into our first miracle, the feeding of the 5,000. And verse 3, and Jesus went up into a mountain, and there he sat with the disciples. This was a common thing that he did. You'll see this throughout the Gospels. What he would do is go up kind of on an elevated surface. His disciples would be kind of an inner circle near him. And that's kind of culturally, that's the kind of thing going on when you have people who were followers of a teacher. They would always be near him, closest to him, to be able to not miss a word. They didn't follow back or worry about crowd control or anything like that. They were there just to learn. That's what disciples were. They're there hanging on Christ's every word and able to interact with him, ask questions, and meet his needs, and kind of serve him. So that's what's going on here. So Jesus going up there. This also gives him a chance to look out at the crowd and be able to speak. Also gives you an advantage with acoustics. And in fact, I've heard if you go over there and go to some of these hills, that there are very great natural acoustics that someone can speak and be heard for quite a distance. So Jesus is up here speaking, verse 5, and when Jesus lifted up his eyes and saw a great company come unto him, he saith unto Philip, whence shall we buy bread that these may eat? So Christ has looked out, realized that there is a huge crowd here, it's getting late in the day, they're going to get hungry. They've been out there listening to him teach maybe for quite some time, they've traveled a long way, they really weren't prepared to stay that long. So many people evidently did not have provision. Some must have, we'll find, because at least one little boy did. But Christ has compassion on them, and he's going to meet the need. Now he's going to put Philip a little bit to a test here. And we'll see Philip's, because verse 6, and this he said to prove him, for he himself knew what he would do. So Christ knows what he's going to do. He's just asking Philip to see what Philip's answer was going to be. Now, Philip answered him, 200 penny worth of bread is not sufficient for them, that every one of them may take a little. Now, how much is 200 penny worth of bread? The word there, penny, in fact, the penny throughout the New Testament, that is the Roman denarius. It's much different than the American penny. It's when they translate this, they equate that to the English penny, which is pretty close. But that's the Roman denarius. And so Philip estimates 200 denarii, when you use the Latin pronunciation there. According to my deal, okay, a denarius was a common laborer's pay per day, one denarius per day. We can find that in the scripture too, from the parable of the workers being paid a penny, being paid a penny for the day. So if we were to work that out and say that, you know, they average making 360 denarii, or whatever, a year, we equate that to modern terms and say that's average household income is about about $40,000 here in America at this time. So this would be maybe about half a year's income. So let's say it's $20,000. That's an easy way. It's not a good way to equate ancient prices to today. Many economic and technological factors there. But let's just say that's somewhere around $20,000. That's pretty easy using my little scenario I laid out for you, if you were able to follow that. So Philip says, hey, it's going to cost $20,000, and we don't have it. So, verse 8, and one of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, saith to him, there is a lad here, which hath 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes, but what are they among so many? So Andrew has found an answer. He says, look, hey, I found somebody who's got a lunch he's willing to share with us. The only problem is it's a very small lunch, and I don't think it's going to be able to go very far. So far, Philip has thrown his hands up in there and says, look, there's no way. I don't know if he must have an experience catering. So he said, there's no way, we don't have enough money. There's not enough bread, in the whole county for us to feed all these people. Andrew says, well, I'll do what I can. I'm not just going to throw my hands up in there. Andrew says, I'll do what I can. Hey, here's a little bitty lunch. Here's, a sack lunch. But we've got thousands of people out there to feed. So, but Andrew has found a possible solution. Verse 10, and Jesus said, make the men sit down. Now there's much grass in the place, so the men sat down. In number, about 5,000. So 5,000 men. We don't know how many women and children. I've heard estimations of 20, 30,000 on this. We know there's 5,000 men. We don't know how many women followed them and if they happened to bring their kids and whatnot. So there was thousands of people. 10, 15, 20,000 is probably not unreasonable. And that's not even unreasonable for a crowd to gather to hear someone speak and following a teacher, especially someone doing this. That's not a very fanciful number by ancient standards. Now today, that's a really good crowd, 5,000 people for just about anything. But by ancient standards, you'll read stories about thousands of people going and hearing orators or meeting Caesar or something. So I don't have a problem with that number at all. Most people don't, but anyway. Something else kind of interesting, it says there's much grass in the place. Evidently it was a hay field is what some of the commentaries kind of allude to there, is that that much grass is evident. This was a freshly mowed pasture, so that it was nice and cut where people could lay down. It wasn't just a prairie or a field. That this was like a freshly mowed lawn almost, and so that people could be there comfortably. So that's what some of the commentaries say. I don't know. I'm not an expert on that, but I've had more than one say that. So just to give you a better picture of it, Jesus and his followers are kind of up on the hillside, and all the people are out there listening, sitting out on this freshly mowed, cut grass. Now, of course, they didn't have mowers back then. They would use like a scythe and do it. But nevertheless, you have this freshly mowed hay field. Maybe even the hay is still, grass is still bundled up and stuff out there. We don't know. Just speculation there. So, verse 11, Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed to the disciples, and the disciples to them that sat down, and likewise of the fishes as much as they would. So, I think I skipped over verse 9, didn't I? Yeah. Little boy has 5 barley loaves and 2 small fishes. So, Jesus takes it and gives thanks. Of course, that is, asking the blessing, however you want to say it now. He prays over it. And God is going to answer his prayer in this. He then takes those small fish, those small little biscuits. Now, what were those? The fish were probably at least closest thing I can equate to in is like a panfish, kind of like a perch, is what most people believe. A small perch, probably the whole thing, kind of like fried, is what some of the stuff I read. And the 5 small barley loaves, that's a very poor meal. Barley is kind of the common man's food. Wheat would have been used for a little bit higher end food. So this was a very poor boy. These loaves, probably better equated to biscuits. This was a very small lunch. So, think of how much a 10-year-old kid could eat. And back then, the people weren't quite as big as they are today. They didn't have as much food. There wasn't McDonald's everywhere. There wasn't a Sam's Club. So this small homemade meal, very small, very small portions here. Jesus takes those and then distributes those small fish, those small small loaves, and I guess he breaks them and divides them among the disciples. The disciples then, I guess, and maybe they're holding it in a like a napkin or a basket or something. They then go and start to pass that out to the people. And can you imagine the first one Peter goes to and says, "Well, I don't, you know, we didn't have very much to start with. Now it's divided by 12. What in the world am I going to do with this? But hey, Jesus said do it. So here you go, sir. How would you like some fish? Would you like some bread? Just help yourself. It's not much there. But go ahead and get you some." And the fellow reaches in and gets a little bit. Peter looks down. There's still some there. And as it keeps going, people are able to get as much food as they want, and yet it's never exhausted. Verse 12. When they were filled, he said unto his disciples, "Gather up the fragments that remain, that nothing be lost." I like this. Jesus, waste not, want not here. Jesus is not going to waste those leftovers. So the disciples then go out with baskets, and they fill up 12 baskets full of leftovers. Verse 13, therefore they gathered them together, filled 12 baskets with the fragments of 5 barley loaves, which remained over and above unto them that had eaten. So that little bitty sack lunch has now filled up 12 baskets full of leftovers. So the multiplication of that food is a tremendous miracle. And it's not just that people ate, there was actually leftovers. So that's how does God meet our needs? Over and abundantly. He doesn't just meet our needs, he gives us so much more. He didn't just save us, he gives us so much more than salvation. So, little point that you can take from there. Now, can you also imagine those disciples? What happened to that? Did they take it home, put it in the refrigerator? You know, who knows? They didn't have refrigerators back then. It'd be a little bit hard. But can you imagine them taking that home, maybe to the little boy's mom? The little boy's mom sent them out with a sack lunch to go hear Jesus, and here they come, and they got 12 big baskets full. They got enough leftover bread there for a feast. Can you imagine that? That just always strikes me as a funny situation there. Verse 14, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, "This is of a truth the prophet that should come into the world." Okay, are they impressed because of the miracle? Yes. But they are more impressed that their physical needs are met. And we'll see that coming up. You've got to think historically here and put yourself into these times. These people that were listening to him, most of them are Jewish people. They are downtrodden. They are they have not had an independent king and kingdom since before King Herod. And the Maccabees, of course, had thrown off the rule of the Seleucid Empire. Therefore, a brief period of time, the Jews had a free state once again under the Hasmonean kings, and which ended when Herod came in and became ruler with the help of Rome, and basically Rome was getting involved to get at the Seleucids, and you know, it was a big power grab for Rome. So when Herod came in, Israel, the nation there, becomes a vassal state to Rome through those kings. So the legions are there. There's been a few small rebellions take place. And so, I mean, there's this very heightened tension there that Rome knew this place could erupt at any time. And so there were legions nearby This place just was a thorn in their side. They never could get the Jews to settle down peaceably. Most everywhere else, Rome was able to get the people to live peaceably under their rule, and you know, then could tax them and do what else. But the Jews were much too zealous for their independence, and especially being subjugated to a empire that was very pagan and listen, the Jewish state had been fighting for its very survival, not just politically, but even with even philosophically, with the inroads of Hellenism, the Greek lifestyle and thought. So, I mean, amid all that, their very hope of survival politically, nationally, and even spiritually has been under assault. These people, they've been downtrodden. Plus, you put that they were very poor people to start with. This was not a very rich district. They were heavily taxed. In fact, there were one of the things that led to a lot of the unrest was the fact that several of the Roman leaders called procurators and the vassal kings at the time, like Agrippa and different ones, even Herod, that they the way it worked, Rome would tell them, okay, you can be in charge and we'll help you as long as you give us, 5,000 denarii of silver, each year. And so, and as long as they got their money, they didn't care. So what that king would do is, okay, I need 5,000 denarii or whatever. That's not, they usually measured it in talents. But anyway, so what he would do is raise taxes. So he made 10,000. So he could pocket the rest of that. That's the way the Roman tax collectors even worked with Zacchaeus. You'll remember that what he did is he had a quota he had to meet, and anything he got above the quota, he got to keep. So as long as he could, whatever he could get in, he could take. Same thing happened with the vassal kings. So so all this going on, these people are poor, they're downtrodden, and in the midst of all this uncertainty and just the general uncertainty of ancient life, here's this man that just fed their bellies from nothing. This to them would just be like spinning straw into gold, like in Rumpelstiltskin, the old kid's tale. This was major. It wasn't just that the miracle taking place. Jesus had done more miracles, but boy, these people said, this man, we must make this man king because he can feed us. Listen, we get so spoiled in our modern day, we don't worry about where our next meal comes from. When we go to the grocery store and get more food, we could probably still survive for a week or two on what we have in stock. Most of these people, the stuff that they basically live day to day. I mean, they when they prayed, "Give us this day our daily bread," as the Lord taught them in the model prayer, that was very true in many circumstances. They didn't know where their next meal was coming from. They just prayed when they went out there that their little garden, that the vegetables will still be there, that the rabbits and whatever didn't get, the foxes didn't get into it. We're very spoiled. And I tell you what, though, once you take care of that food thing and, you pretty much are going to survive, generally speaking, then you can really do a lot of neat things. And this was a big question for those ancient people. So these people look at Jesus. Wow, this is amazing. He can feed us. Wow, this is amazing. Let's go after this guy. We don't have to work anymore. So verse 15. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. So Jesus knows what's going on. He knows the hearts of men. So he gets away from there because he can't trust them. This is a general thing. Jesus didn't come to be an earthly king. Now, this was a good step. If he wanted to be an earthly king, he just made a bunch of fans right here. He got a bunch of loyal followers because he filled their bellies. But that's not what Jesus' goal was. So Jesus gets away from there. He retreats up into the mountain, gets away from there so the people can't find him. So now that verse kind of transitions us into the next. Jesus is going to escape away from there, and this is where Jesus is going to be walking on the water. Verse 16, and when even was now come, when night time has come, it's got dark, his disciples went down to a ship. And verse 17, and entered into a ship and went over the sea toward Capernaum, and it was now dark, and Jesus was not come to them. So Jesus sends them on, says, look, y'all go, get away from here, I'll catch up. So probably with the uncertainty with the throng, the people, maybe the disciples figured this was something for his own safety, that he had this under control. He would sneak down there or walk down there by himself, maybe attract a lot less attention. So anyway, they get in their boat and they sail to Capernaum. This is somewhere about 5 or 6 miles away, maybe about 5 miles, I think, according to the maps I was looking at. And it is west of there, so they've gotten their boat, and they're really kind of just sailing along. This isn't like they're going all the way across the clear to the other side of the lake. They're actually kind of going just across a corner of the lake there to get to Capernaum. And verse 18, and the sea arose by reason of a great wind that blew. So here we have a storm that's come up. The waves are getting high. I've heard that the waves get very high under storms. This is a very large lake, so the wind can sweep through there and has enough room to really get some high waves. I've been on some large lakes, around Texas and stuff. Lake Texoma is a pretty good sized lake, and I've never really been out in the ocean. I've been on some bodies of water when there's a little bit of wind and the waves get up, 2 or 3 feet, and you get a little nervous. They say that under storm conditions that I want to say I've heard that the waves can get to be like 10 to 12 feet under certain circumstances. That's pretty major, especially when the boats they'd use were very small boats. You can do a little research. They actually found a boat from this time period. They call it the Jesus boat. It's in a museum in Israel, but you can actually look it up. It is a very, very small boat. I don't remember how, I want to say it's only about 12, 15 feet long or so. So the disciples were pretty much packed into this boat. And so they're in here. Now, remember, there's expert fishermen in here. These men have been out on the water. Peter, those guys have been out on the water before. They've been in storms before. This, can you imagine them trying to calm everybody? Hey, hey, Thaddeus, don't worry about it, man. Boy, this ain't nothing. Hey, John, you remember, boy, remember that time 5 years ago we were out and the waves got up 20 foot high? Maybe they're telling stories, trying to calm everybody. But there really gets to a point here that they're getting pretty scared, I really believe. Verse 19, so when they had rowed about 5 and 20 or 30 furlongs, they see Jesus walking on the sea and drawing nigh unto the ship, and they were afraid. Now, according to my measurements on this, not out there with a tape measure, but on maps and stuff, 25 or 30 furlongs equates to somewhere around 4 miles. So they are actually probably within a half mile to a mile of their destination. They're 80-90% done with their trip. And but they've been rowing and rowing and rowing against this with this wind, and all of a sudden, as they're just trying to make it to shore to save their own lives, they look up and here comes Christ walking on the water. What a sight that must have been. And of course, this story is given in other passages, Matthew 14:22-36, Mark 6:45-56. It's given a couple of times. There's a little bit more details given in those. I'm going to kind of stick with the details in this story, just for the sake of brevity, because I've kind of gone on a little bit long, but you can look those up. But Jesus, then verse 20, and he saith unto them, it is I, be not afraid. Remember from the other passages that they thought, oh no, it's a ghost, or it's a spirit. What are we going to do? Jesus says, no, hey, folks, you know me. Remember me. It's me, Jesus. Hello. So everything's okay. Just let me come. And verse 21, and they willingly received him into the ship. Immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. I like this. They willingly got him into the boat. Isn't that funny? It's like, I would want, if I was in the middle of a storm, I'd want Jesus there. Not just physically speaking, but in life, when the storms of life beat upon me, I want to make sure I've got Jesus there. And I'll tell you what, in those times, yes, I welcome Christ into my life and into my circumstances. I want him beside me, because I know if he's there, he can calm the sea. I know that he can take care of it, and I know he can protect me. So just an application there from that passage. Verse 20, and continually immediately the ship was at the land whither they went. Now, some commentaries I read, they actually put this as a separate miracle. that immediately when he got into the boat, they were right there where they're supposed to be. So that basically, as he got in there, they just miraculously were from point A to point B, just right there. So transported, I guess you could say, translated maybe, but they just immediately, they weren't there before he got in the boat, but when he got in the boat, they were there. You can think of your own term for it. So a lot of people say, now according to my measurements and stuff, they were probably pretty doggone close to it, but as I say, some people do count that, some of the commentaries do count that as a separate miracle. So that wraps up these two miracles. Let's kind of review it real quick. Review of the miracles there have. There's kind of four different ones, I guess you could say, I have listed out. The first would be that the five barley loaves and two small fish fed 5,000 plus women and children. So that small sack lunch fed 15, 20,000 people, was multiplied, I mean, thousands of times to be able to feed them. I think related to that, not only were all those people fed, but 12 baskets of leftovers. So you have even further proof that of the miracle that happened, also showing us that God doesn't just meet our needs, he meets them abundantly. Third thing, that Jesus walks on the water in the storm. Isn't it good to know that in the storms of life, Jesus isn't scared to meet us, isn't scared to be by us. Whatever we get into, Jesus can be right there. Think about the three Hebrew children in the book of Daniel are cast into the fiery furnace. Who was there? The Son of God, fourth man walking around there. So Jesus can be right there. He can come to you in any circumstance. He'll be there with you. And the fourth miracle is the boat miraculously arrives at destination when Jesus is aboard. You know, when Jesus comes on the scene, things happen. Things change. And he can fix those problem circumstances in our life. He can fix those troubling situations. When Jesus comes in, things change. When he comes into our hearts the first time, when at salvation, he miraculously changes our residence from, you know, the place downstairs to the place upstairs. We get to move on up. We're no longer bound for hell. We're headed to heaven. In fact, we're citizens there. We're just as good as if we were there. You want to study that out. But even in our life, when Jesus comes in, boy, the times we've had trouble in our life, you wonder, how am I going to pay this bill? I've been there before thinking, God, I need a little bit of money. And then a check comes in the mail. I remember one time when I was in college, wrapping it near the end of a semester. And actually, it was my senior year. And I believe it was the beginning of the spring semester. I was, you know, a few months away still from graduation. And me and my wife, I was already married at the time. We were really strapped for money and, you know, didn't make much. Plus, you've got all the other, starting a family there. Just me and my wife, but still, you know, you're married and trying to furnish an apartment and pay the school bills and all the other stuff, you know, that you're young and stupid and spend money on. But I remember needing a little bit of money, and I was praying, God, would you just please send me? I believe it was $50. I said, God, if you could send me $50, it sure would help me through this. And a few days passed. I'd kind of forgotten about the prayer. It's amazing how we do that. We pray something real serious and we forget about it, and God answers. It happens all the time to me. But had a card come in the mail, and it was a graduation card. And I'd say, this was the first one I got. It was 2 or 3 months ahead of schedule. But I had a great aunt just send me one out of the blue, and it was for that $50, I believe it was. And I tell you what, boy, it was exciting. And it was even a blessing to her. I called and spoke with her and thanked her for it, and I told her that, you know, we had been praying for it, and she just said, well, you know, I had it on my mind, I didn't want to forget, so I went ahead and sent it. And I thought, wow, it's amazing how God answers prayers. So these are two famous miracles. You hear quite a bit about them. Don't let the familiarity make them less amazing to you. These were mighty miracles that Christ worked. There's a lot of applications we can draw from them. I mean, even there's dozens of songs been written about each of these too. But don't let the familiarity get to you. There's a lot of good stuff here, a lot of good application we could go with. Just remember, Jesus is the miracle worker. Jesus can meet those impossible needs, whether it be feeding 5,000 or getting you safely through a storm. Christ can meet those needs. If he can get us to heaven, he can get us through just about anything else. In fact, he can't get us through anything else. Pardon my little lapse of English there. Just remember to have your faith and trust in the one who has no limits, who has no end to his power, who has no end to his love for us. And make sure he's in the boat with you when you go out and you got those storms of life come. Make sure he's close. I appreciate you listening, and I'll quit my rambling. We'll get on to lesson number 15 next, the bread of life, and hope that you enjoy that. Appreciate you listening. Thank you.